This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
One thing about us, humans imagine their legacy. Think of Stonehenge and the pyramids. I assumed our lasting sign would be nuclear waste, but it could be carbon from your last tank of gas. In fact, our guest David Archer explains how humans are changing the next 100,000 years of Earth's climate. Dr. Archer teaches geophysical sciences at the University of Chicago. In addition to respected scientific papers, he has written a climate primer for students, followed by the award-winning book From Here to Eternity, Global Warming and Geologic Time, published in 2008. Like Alan Robach, our guest next week, David Archer is a frequent contributor to the web's top climate science blog at realclimate.org. Archer's new book is more of a warning. Its short title is The Long Thaw. David Archer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Can we dive right in? Will you tell us what the long thaw is?
The long thaw is the result of releasing carbon dioxide to the biosphere, taking it out of the ground and putting it into the fast carbon cycle of the Earth. Will change the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years. So that's the long part.
So are we predicting an ice-free planet, for example?
Well, I guess if we were to combust all of the coal and wait 10,000 years, I wouldn't be surprised if a significant amount of the ice could melt. I don't know. The East Antarctic ice sheet, climate scientists don't think about it that much because it's so stable. So whether, you know, the whole Antarctica could melt ultimately from combusting all the fossil fuel, I don't know. Well, but it's borderline. It's in there. It's in that range.
We have had hothouse conditions before on the Earth where there was no ice at the poles, or let's say in the Arctic, for example.
That's true.
You say that the right conditions for a new ice age are coming up in a few thousand years, and again in another cycle about 50,000 years. We all know that ice sheets a mile thick over your city of Chicago would be a real disaster. Won't humans of the future, just to be the devil's advocate here, won't those humans thank us for preventing another ice age?
Well, the theory that upon which I based the statement that you sort of attribute to me is that the intensity of sunlight in the northern hemisphere summer is what triggers the onset of glaciation, the nucleation of an ice sheet. And looking in the past, there is a critical value of that sunlight intensity at which, if you're in an interglacial time, the ice sheet tends to nucleate, but it's not known very, very precisely what that trigger value is. So the minimum in solar intensity that's coming in the next some thousands of years is right in the gray zone of where that trigger could be. So it's kind of, the model isn't really precise enough to say yes or no. It's sort of a close call. But at any rate, in terms of the social implication of this, is what you asked about. All of this is thousands of years into the future, and there'd be no way that we'd be considering putting CO2 into the atmosphere to defend ourselves against this ice sheet if it, you know, we weren't already doing it. That would be kind of a wacky idea.
Well, James Hansen certainly doesn't think that's a good idea. He doesn't want to see an ice-free world. I noticed in your book you predict a period of climate storms, you call them, for a couple of hundred years during the transition, but you don't give many details. What do you mean by climate storms?
Oh, I meant that after CO2 is released to the atmosphere, there's a few centuries when the airborne fraction is fairly high because it takes time to dissolve in the ocean. And so I wanted to convey the idea of a peak of warming that lasts a few centuries and then a long tail that lasts for hundreds of thousands of years. So as a name for this peak, I came up with climate storm, singular, not climate storms like, you know, some kind of hurricanes or, you know, events or something like that. That's what I was trying to convey.
Well, what might happen during that peak period? I know I'm just asking you to guess at this point, but what would be a reasonable assumption?
Well, it depends entirely on what the peak temperatures get to. The goal of many organizations now is and governments is to try to figure out how to limit the warming, the average temperature of the Earth, to less than about 2 degrees centigrade. And if that's, you know, if we manage to do that, that'd be a very, very different story from if it goes sort of uncontrolled to 5 or 7 degrees centigrade or something like that in the coming centuries. So 2 degrees C is warmer than the Earth has been in millions of years, and last time it was that much warmer, the sea level was significantly higher, and, you know, even that is a pretty frightening prospect. But 5 or 6 degrees, you know, you're talking about a different planet.
Well, that leads me to another question in my mind. It might take me a second to express this. It's about whether temperatures can go down if we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions a little later in this century. I mean, say carbon dioxide pollution continues to increase for the next 10 years, but we start emissions in 2030, and that's what the governments and the public are assuming that we could do, and the climate would respond with less warming. But February's Academy Journal with the article with Susan Solomon and her team suggests that natural system may continue on with whatever CO2 peak we manage to hit. The later emission cuts may not matter. Is that your understanding as well?
On the one hand, the result of climate models seems to be that there was a series of papers in Nature just 6 months or so ago on this, that the most important thing that predicts how, you know, what the most severe climate the planet will experience, the thing that best predicts that, if you sort of try tweaking the CO2 emission scenarios, let's try cutting now, let's try cutting later, and all of that, is the total amount of CO2 that ever gets released. So it kind of simplifies things, because if you, you know, don't cut now, you'll have to cut later. It just sort of makes it easier to think about. So in that case, your question of, well, could we sort of continue business as usual 2030 and then start cutting then, you know, could be sort of right. Now, the problem is that in order to keep the total slug of CO2 below some amount that is going to be the danger threshold, if we wait till 2030, we have to cut by, I forget the exact number, but it's sort of 10 or 15% per year, whereas if we were to start cutting now, cuts of 2% a year could wind us up at the same place at the end of the century. And cutting by 2% a year would be a lot cheaper than cutting by 10% a year. By 2040, you basically have to stop cold turkey, or you're over the line.
Well, that's a little bit different than what George Monbiot takes out of that study in his article in The Guardian. He's really concerned about a peak that could be reached soon, and then we really can't unwind from that. It just carries on, and I wanted to get your feeling about that.
Well, it is certainly possible that, so during the ice ages, the overall climate was paced by the variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And somehow, in a way that we don't understand very well, the carbon cycle amplified that climate forcing from the orbit. So, you know, the orbit would warm things up and melt some ice a little bit, and then the CO2 would go up and make it warm up even more. Today, the carbon cycle is damping out our climate change by absorbing CO2 into the oceans and into forests, but it's entirely reasonable to imagine that on some time scale, the carbon cycle could start adding CO2 and amplifying what we do, which is sort of a tipping point that I think is what you may be sort of referring to. And the fact that we don't understand the past very well means that we have, you know, zero confidence at predicting the future. So I'd say it's an open question whether the carbon cycle could suddenly go bananas and start putting lots of carbon into the atmosphere that we wouldn't be able to then stop. That's possible.
Well, you have put a lot of work into understanding the past climate ages. It's almost like a kind of time tourism. Do you feel that way sometimes?
Yeah, I have colleagues who are more traditional geologists than I am, and they can walk out in the mountains and see all these past worlds. I can only read about them. I don't have that vision. It is amazing, though.
I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience of reading your book. First of all, it's mercifully short. We're all really busy these days, and when somebody hands me a 500-page tome, I can't do it. But I did read your book, and I was thinking of skipping ahead to your main theme past the first few chapters, but I'm glad I didn't, because I had to unlearn some of the previous science and some myths. I was thinking, for example, about the role of sunspots. You know, there's 1,000 YouTube posters and anonymous blog commenters who say very authoritatively that all this warming is caused by sunspots. And even last night's TV news suggested solar flares may have warmed the Pacific to create the El Nino for this year. How do we know the sun is not the main cause of our present climate shift?
Well, because there is satellite measurements of the intensity of the sun going back through the last few decades when the Earth has warmed in a way that is kind of the smoking gun for CO2, for human impact on climate. So there hasn't been a trend in the sun brightness that could explain the warming.
And we haven't had sunspots for a little while.
I guess we are in kind of a low. Just this year, we're in a particularly low. I just was reading an email about that today. I don't know much about it, but yes, I guess that's true.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and most climate models and reports stop at the year 2100. But what happens in the longer future once we've altered the atmosphere and the sea? These are questions that are the topic of a new book, The Long Thaw, by scientist David Archer. David, can you explain how just 1 gallon of gas can keep on heating the atmosphere many times over?
Well, once the carbon is released, there is a fraction of it, about a quarter. It depends on how much other carbon is released, because as you release carbon, it acidifies the ocean and changes its chemistry and changes how much CO2 it will take up. But about a quarter of the carbon from that gallon of gas will continue to be in the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years until chemical reactions with igneous rocks on land will ultimately carry the carbon back into the Earth in the form of calcium carbonate. So the Earth has this natural stabilizing feedback mechanism in the carbon cycle, but it takes a long time to operate. And, you know, with it we can understand the climate changes in the geologic past, like the ice-free climates you mentioned earlier, and we also can predict what will happen to the fossil fuel CO2. So it may not be the exact same CO2 molecules. CO2 is taken up by plants, and, you know, there's CO2 dissolving in the ocean one place and coming out someplace else. And so if you actually ask how long will a particular carbon dioxide molecule stay in the air, the answer is very different. It's something like 5 years or something like that. But the crucial thing is that after you put CO2 into the carbon cycle, it's like a rising tide that floats all boats. There's more in the ocean, there's more in the trees, and there's more in the atmosphere, and it has to stay that way until finally this weathering reaction can clean it up on a time scale of 500,000 years or something.
So we can make a really lasting impression every day as we head to the pumps.
Yeah, it's true. The evolution of our understanding of our place in the universe has been kind of discouraging. You know, it's not clear that the planet was created for us, and we're not the center of the universe, we're not even the center of the solar system, but we are players in geologic time.
You know, scientists started studying the global warming problem really in earnest in the early 1990s, in my opinion. But I wonder, why has it taken us so long to realize the urgency of our situation?
Well, you want to see it in the data. You don't. It wouldn't be like humankind to take precautions based on predictions. You sort of want to see, and then we do start to see it now. But in the 1990s, it wasn't so clear that this was happening. Although actually, you know, the forecast for global warming goes back much further than that. It was forecast long before it was observed. I will point that out.
Yeah, about 100 years ago at least.
That's true. Cervantes Arrhenius in 1896, he used measurements of moonbeams to predict that doubling CO2 in the atmosphere would raise the temperature about 5 degrees C. Now they say 2.5 to 4.5 or something like that.
And I wonder, too, though, whether the sort of combined pressure of the fossil fuel lobby, who make billions, countless billions out of this, and our own, I wouldn't say joy, but real enjoyment of flying across the surface of the Earth in cars and using all the wonders of power, all of that kind of dulls the edge of conceiving that we're doing this damage.
Well, it's true that historically fossil fuel consumption has led to prosperity of nations. There's no question about that. But the prediction is that we can wean ourselves from this at a pretty negligible impact to our standard of living. We don't have to go back to living like the Flintstones. We can come up with smarter ways of doing things. Actually, efficiency, for the next couple of decades, there's a lot more room to cut emissions just by making things more efficient, because it's never been a priority before, so there's lots of what they call low-hanging fruit.
And in the end, you conclude our biggest problem isn't with the technology or even finding the money, but with ethics. Sort of, do we, the common oil and coal burners of this century, have the right to dictate the climate for all conceivable generations to come? David, could you talk to us about ethics and whether you think it's possible a basic sense of right and wrong could still prevent this climate problem?
Well, not only is there the unfairness between those of us benefiting now and those paying the price in the distant future, but there's also a division between the benefit accrues to the rich industrial world and the price is paid mostly in sort of the tropical developing world. So I sometimes you hear people trying to analyze the situation by balancing the cost of cutting CO2 emissions against the cost of the climate change, and it sort of sweeps over the whole fairness issue. I think an analogy could be drawn to slavery, which ended not because it was financially agreeable move to make, but because it was simply wrong.
In the event that we don't make that change, do you have any thoughts about humans, how they could prepare for the long thaw? Tough one.
Boy, I imagine when you have famines and mass migrations, I see, failed states and boy, it's not something, you could pack away some canned goods or something, but geez, that sounds scary.
It's not really something you can plan for. It's just something we either survive or we don't, I suppose. So the alternative is perhaps a working agreement in Copenhagen and a lot of personal changes from all of us, and we hope we make it.
Well, it seems to me like social changes sometimes happen kind of abruptly. And if the forecast for the changing climate is correct, the pressure from the natural world will only increase. And so it seems to me it's only a matter of time till we figure out how to do things differently.
We're talking with scientist David Archer, and I just wanted to ask you as we wrap up, what are you working on now, and what do you think you'll be working on next?
I'm working on methane hydrates. They are these weird ice compounds that you find in sediments of the ocean, and they're frightening for climate because there's lots of them, so much of this methane that they could really clobber the radiative balance of the atmosphere if they somehow got out all at once. So we're trying to understand better how the methane cycle works in the sediments. I'm also working on a compendium of classic global warming papers, including my favorite, Svante Arrhenius 1896, which will be called The Warming Papers, kind of like the Pentagon Papers, and another book which is about the carbon cycle of the Earth.
That's fantastic. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has been Professor David Archer from the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate, from Princeton University Press. Its style is clear. The book is small with a really big punch, I thought. I've read it, and I recommend The Long Thaw as one of the top climate books of the year so far. Thank you, Dr. Archer, for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been fun.
During that interview with David Archer, I referred to another newly developing concept coming out of the latest climate science. Dr. Archer correctly says the bottom line is, how much carbon and other greenhouse gases do we put into the atmosphere? But in his Guardian newspaper column in Britain, climate activist George Monbiot raises another issue. Does it matter when that pollution goes up there?
But the atmosphere doesn't care. It doesn't brook any excuses. The atmosphere is not concerned because it's incapable of being concerned. All that counts is how much carbon dioxide is produced, not whether or not there's a good reason for producing that carbon dioxide.
The standard government climate plan assumes a bell curve kind of thing. Greenhouse gas emissions, they just keep on rising to a peak, where we manage to get them under control somehow, and then they fall off gradually, maybe after 2050. Perhaps we adapt a new low-energy economy or replace oil and coal with clean renewables. Their model assumes the climate will cool off as we stop emitting. Now we know that isn't the case. As new research shows, climate change will keep on going long after we stop. As George Monbiot writes in his column, August 31, 2009, three papers released earlier this year changed all that. The first one, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in February, set the scene. It showed that the climate change we cause today, quote, is largely irreversible for 1,000 years after emissions stop, end quote. Around 40% of the carbon dioxide produced by humans this century will remain in the atmosphere for at least until the year 3000. Moreover, thanks to the peculiar ways in which the oceans absorb heat from the atmosphere, global average temperatures are likely to, quote, remain approximately constant until the end of the millennium, despite zero further emissions, end quote. And that ends the quote from George Monbiot as well. Find the whole article at monbiot.com, spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T. In fact, as we now know from David Archer, the climate shift we are now creating is likely to last at least 100,000 years until the slow decarbonizing by rocks takes place. But Monbiot adds a new twist. Drawing from new science released by teams headed by Miles Allen and by Malte Meinhausen, we show that we have very little time left to use fossil fuels before we send the climate into unlivable heating, perhaps as much as 6 degrees Celsius warmer. Again, quoting from Monbiot, there are some obvious conclusions from these three papers. The trajectory of cuts is more important than the final destination. An 80% cut by 2050, for example, could produce very different outcomes. If most of the cut were made towards the beginning of the period, the total emissions entering the atmosphere would be much smaller than if most of the cuts were made at the end of the period. The measure that counts is the peak atmospheric concentration. This must be as low as possible and come as soon as possible, which means making most of the reductions right now, ensuring that we don't exceed the cumulative emissions discussed in the Nature papers, means setting an absolute limit to the amount of fossil fuel we can burn, which, as my rough sums show, is likely to be much smaller than the reserves already identified. It means a global moratorium on prospecting and developing new fields. End quote from George Monbiot. So there's no need to keep prospecting for more oil or coal. We can't burn what we already have. That's a point raised way back in the 1990s by former Greenpeace scientist Jeremy Leggett. Jeremy will be joining us on Radio EcoShock in a couple of weeks. But the real kicker George raises, we need to cut carbon quickly now, not in the politician's slow process where humans finally clean up their act after 2050. We just can't wait. Monbiot endorses the new film, The Age of Stupid, which is launching a 10-10 campaign in Britain. Cut 10% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions in 2010. Make significant cuts in the upcoming year. We all need to do that.
It's like looking through binoculars, observing people on a far-off beach, running around in circles, fixated on the small area of sand under their feet as a tsunami races towards the shore.
101 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the hottest day ever recorded.
The Age of Stupid is narrated by Pete Postlethwaite. speaking from the year 2055 after the catastrophe. It's set to premiere in North America on September 21st and 22nd, originating from a solar power tent in New York City to 442 cinemas in North America and more in another 45 other countries. Radiohead will sing live at the opening. Catch this film if you can.
Every scientific report, all stored on banks of servers. The amazing thing is, we had the chance to avert this. I mean, the conditions we are experiencing now were actually caused by our behavior in the period leading up to 2015. In other words, we could have saved ourselves.
One last quote from David Archer's book, The Long Thaw. If we add up the total amount of energy trapped by the CO2 from a gallon of gas over its atmospheric lifetime, we find that our gallon of gasoline ultimately traps 100 billion kilocalories of useless and unwanted greenhouse heat. The bad energy from burning that gallon ultimately outweighs the good energy by a factor of about 40 million. The enormous world-altering potential of that gallon of gasoline has taken the reins of Earth's climate away from its natural stabilizing feedback systems and given them to us. May we use our newfound powers wisely. And let's face it, now we know, we are choosing a climate for all conceivable generations of humans. Our brand of species has only been around for about the last 140,000 years. Civilization is less than 10,000 years old. Now we're setting up the planet for 100,000 years or more. Will we leave Eden? Or a tough and troubled place where the remnant huddle near the poles to escape the heat left behind by the fossil fools.
When you use a gallon of gasoline, you consume a gallon of gasoline, you add 5 pounds of carbon to the atmosphere. When I ask people this question in an audience, most people think it's just a minute amount, because it's very deceptive that carbon dioxide is an odorless, colorless gas. It's a gas, it floats. It doesn't seem like it has weight or mass, but most of a gallon of gasoline is carbon. It's a complex hydrocarbon. It weighs about 6 pounds. About 5 pounds of that is carbon. And all of that goes into the atmosphere.